Morning. It's good to see all of y'all. Just as a reminder, we do have for the kiddos the sheets in the back where you can take notes. And if you present those notes to me after services, you'll get one of the candies that's back there. I mention that because I've really enjoyed getting to see those notes and seeing the pictures that everybody draws and how that kind of sinks in, you know, as kids listen to these lessons and the words of Jesus and how they process that. So that's always been something I've enjoyed when I get to look at those. We're going to continue in our sermon series that we have been working through all of this month about forgiveness, and we've put special emphasis on the challenge of forgiveness and how that has unfolded throughout, especially the Gospel of Matthew, although we're spending some time in Luke's Gospel this period of our study. But we recognize that forgiving one another is something that we find especially challenging, that we see that is so hard, that relationships are hard, that there are struggles, there are difficulties that arise in that. We've spent a lot of time this year talking about that. But because of our experiences, because of our relationships and how difficult that seems to be at times, we find it often difficult to receive forgiveness. We find it difficult to see God as a forgiving God. Just because we have a hard time with it. We just have a hard time wrapping our head around this concept of fully and completely and totally forgiving somebody to where you restore them back into fellowship. And that's what makes it so hard. And last week we introduced the idea of the table fellowship that the Jewish people celebrated, that people would come together and sit at a table together. And when they sat at that table together, that identified them as part of that particular group, that those are the people who are in. And the people who are not at the table are those who are out, the included and the excluded, and how Jesus plays on that in the Gospel of Luke as we read through Luke's Gospel, and how Luke emphasizes this, that Jesus is going to quite literally turn the tables on this table fellowship, where he is going to call everybody to God's table, regardless of where they grew up or who they are or what they have done, that Jesus is calling people to sit at God's table. And in God's reality, it's not going to be those who sit at the head of the table who are the greatest, and those who sit at the foot of the table who are the least. But in Jesus's world, the greatest will be the least, and the least will be the greatest. And so he is quite literally turning the tables on this analogy and bringing us to a reality that God is a forgiving God. And if you don't hear anything from any of these sermon series, in these lessons that we've been looking at, that's what I want you to hear, that God is a forgiving God. And he is drawing us in. He is calling us in. He is inviting us. But we often come up with all sorts of excuses as to why we cannot come to the table. So this morning, we're going to continue that idea. We're going to be looking at Luke chapter 15. And in this particular scenario, in this scene, we have Jesus not sitting with the Pharisee like we had last week in his table, but we have Jesus interacting and having fellowship with tax collectors and what the Pharisees would call the outsiders, the sinners. And it says in verse 1, it says, talks about how the tax collectors and the sinners were all gathering around to hear. And the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Now, this should have been a reason for celebration, right? I mean, you thinking about who Jesus is and what he's going to accomplish, it should have been a reason for the Pharisees to celebrate that. you know, to celebrate the fact that Jesus is calling in sinners to him, to listen to him and eat with him, that is a means of celebration. But they turn it around and they use it as a way to criticize and attack Jesus and lower his status amongst the people. And the religious leaders are just having a hard time. They're having a hard time coming to grips with this very idea that Jesus would be willing to eat with the outsiders, that Jesus would be willing to eat with the outcasts, the tax collectors and the sinners, that this is just not how things are. And they would look at him and even say to him, you know, don't you know what you're doing? Right? And they would use that to tell other people, don't you see what your rabbi is doing? That this is not the way things are. But Jesus is going to take this opportunity to teach from three parables in this chapter. The first parable that he teaches from is the parable of the lost sheep. And the second parable is the parable of the lost coin. And the third parable, which is the one we're going to focus on this morning, is the parable of the lost son, or as we often refer to it, the prodigal son. So if you would look at verse 11. In verse 11, it's the beginning of this parable that Jesus tells about this lost son to illustrate his point. In verse 11, it says that a man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of your estate that falls to me. So he divided the wealth between them. And not many days later, the young son gathered everything together, and he went on a journey into a distant country, and there he squandered his estate with loose living. All right, so this parable would have been especially shocking to those who heard it the first time. To think that any father, first off, would even be willing to do this would have been shocking. But in order for the son to even receive the inheritance in this culture, the estate, right? It's not like he's going to write him a check out of a savings account or something. There is an estate involved in this inheritance, and a family estate, probably been in the family for hundreds of years, generation after generation. And this son wants his portion, and he wants it now, which means that estate is going to have to be sold, probably to some stranger, right, outside of the family, and he's going to get the money, and he's going to go, because that's what he wants to do. And so even that scenario would have been shocking to people in this culture, because that kind of thing wasn't done. And secondly, the inheritance, the asking of the inheritance, would acknowledge the fact that the son is basically wishing his father to die. I mean, that's how you receive an inheritance. And that's what he's asking, in essence, that his father be like he had died so that I can receive what is owed me at your death, and then I can take it and live my own life. And so all in all, the whole story is set up with this really a shocking, almost impossible scenario in the Jewish culture, and it is insulting. It is insulting to their heritage. It is insulting to their mindset and their culture that this would ever take place. And even the father's response would have been shocking to them. Look at verse 14. It says, now when he had spent everything, so all that they received from the sale of this property, he receives it all, he takes it, and he spends every last dime of it. It says a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be impoverished. And so he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into the fields to feed swine. And it says, and he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. So we can assume, right, from just the way this story lays out in the context, that the family that this boy belongs to is Jewish. We kind of draw that assumption based on the narrative. And we can also assume that the family in which he hires himself out to is most likely Gentile. Because from the law of Moses, we know that the Jews did Nate Bacon, right? I mean, that was kind of how that worked. God forbade them from consuming and eating these certain types of animals. But Gentiles could, and they did, and they often were the ones who raised pigs. And so that seems to be the layout of this story, is here's this boy who receives his inheritance. Very shameful for the family, very shameful for him. He takes all of the money from the sale of this estate, and he goes out and he just blows every dime of it. But now he has found himself in a position where not only has he done that, but he has been forced to hire himself out to a Gentile family and work their swine, work their pigs. And he is so hungry, and he's in such a bad place that he would gladly eat what he is feeding the pigs, because nobody was caring for him. Nobody was loving him. Nobody was taking care of him, right? And we kind of feel sorry for the kid a little bit, but we kind of don't, because we look at the situation and we say, yeah, you're getting what you deserve, right? There's a sense in which there's still part of us that sees this and says, you know, what else did you expect, right? But what this is all supposed to do is it's supposed to help us recognize our shortcomings and our assault to God when we sin. And when, if that were laid out in this story, right, we'd be looking at ourselves and being ashamed of what we have done and what we have done with the Father's inheritance. But look at verse 17. The story continues. It says, but when he came to his senses... And I don't know how long it takes to soften a hard head, but this guy finally comes to his senses. He comes and he realizes at the bottom of the barrel, you know, in the pig muck and mire, and wanting and desiring even what the pigs are eating, that he comes to his senses and he says to himself, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread? But I am dying here with hunger. And then in verse 18, he says, I will get up. You know, he's kind of talking to, having a little counsel with me, you know, he's a little bit of counsel here in the mud, you know, as he's feeding the swine, and he looks over at the container there with all of the food that he just sloshed in for the pigs and the pigs eating. And he's thinking, man, that looks good. I wish I could eat some of that, you know. And then he starts to have a little counsel with himself, and he's thinking, you know, even in the lowest place in my father's family, even the slaves who are not actually part of the family, but they are in a sense, because they work closely with the family. They work on the family estate. At least they get bread. At least they're getting something. And I would be better off if I were a slave in my father's house, rather than being here and working in this pig pen, you know. So he's having a counsel with himself, and he says, self, you know, let's get up, right? Let's go to my father, and I will say to him. So he's going to kind of think about this and narrate this through his mind and rehearse this, you know, to the pigs, of course, right? Because they're the only ones there. And so he's rehearsing this, and he's thinking about it. What am I going to say? And he says, well, I think what I'll say is, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. And the pigs are just indifferent, right? They don't care. You know, they're just after their slop. But here's this young man, and he's in this pig pen, and he's reciting this to himself, and he's thinking about, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? How can I persuade my father, you know, in some way or some fashion, to at least take me back? Because I would be better off as a hired hand, as a slave in my father's house, than here in this place that inevitably he's created for himself, right? And so he's rehearsing this, and he comes to his senses. He basically repents, right? That's the general census here. His idea of repentance, that it is clicked in his mind, that he just feels the remorse. He feels the pressure of his disobedience. He understands what he does, but he doesn't seem to believe at this moment that the Father will forgive him entirely. Now, he believes the Father is merciful, because he wouldn't have asked otherwise. I mean, it is his last hope, after all. But he doesn't seem to understand at this point in the story, in the narrative, that his father is going to restore him, right? But he feels like the father maybe would at least let him come in as a hired hand and help out on the estate that now belongs to his brother. Maybe that would happen. But complete forgiveness? Well, he's not hoping for that yet. That's not even on his radar. He's just hoping to get out of this situation into a better situation, to take the lowest place in the family, to humble himself, to accept the lowest place in the family. That's his hope. That's his desire. Look at verse 20. He says, so he got up and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off. Now, I love the fact that it says that his father saw him, because that kind of implies the father's been waiting, right? I mean, you know, nobody just stands there and watches the road all day and night. But from afar off, he sees his broken son who has been rebellious, who has lived in the slop of the world, who has done horrible things to him and his family, who has insulted everyone that he loves, that he is just this broken man, and he sees them from far off, the father does, and he felt compassion for him. He felt compassion for him. And he ran. The father ran. I don't know, you know, we don't know a whole lot about this culture, but patriarchs don't run. I mean, you know, as a father, I don't run, you know, it's not something I like to do. But I mean, patriarchs back then just didn't run. You know, they were authority figures. They were people that had reputations. They're not going to just go running down the street after somebody. But this patriarch does. He runs and he embraced him, this smelly, yucky kid, right? I mean, this guy that has nothing. He's hopeless. He's broken. And he's just coming back in hopes that his words, the words that he just rehearsed with the swine, are going to be enough that the father would at least let him back and work as a slave. And this man runs to his son and embraces him and kisses him. And then the son starts his speech, right? I mean, he did rehearse it after all. He's ready. You know, I don't even know what I'm going to say to dad. You know, he's there. He's about to rehearse the speech. And he says in verse 21, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Right? This is what makes forgiveness hard for so many. This phrase right here, when this son comes back, humbles himself, and returns, which a lot of us, if we would be willing to admit so, are not even willing to do that. But this son does, as broken as he was. But that phrase right there, I am not worthy. I'm not worthy. What I have done, the assault to the family, the things that I have done, the words that I have said, the actions, I'm really not worthy of your compassion, and I'm not worthy of your forgiveness. But that is the genesis of it, isn't it? That's the beginning of receiving forgiveness, as acknowledging, for one, that we need it, but two, that we're not worthy of it. That if we do receive it, it's not something I have earned, right? It's something that I am given. And unless we can come to grips with that, we're going to struggle all the time in living in light of God's forgiveness. But this is what makes forgiveness so hard. This is what kept the Pharisees from accepting the invitation to come and sit at the table of God in his great banquet of celebration, is because they believed that they were worthy. They believed, because they sat at the right table day in and day out, that they sat with the right people, that they wore the right clothes, that they said the right things, that they kept the law of Moses perfectly, that they did all of these things in such a way that they were worthy. And whomever they said was worthy is worthy. And whoever they invited to their table was worthy. But it's the very thing that is keeping them from sitting at God's table, isn't it? But this son has at least the right attitude to say, I am not worthy. In verse 22, it says, But the father said to his slaves, quickly, you know, go fast, quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and let us celebrate. Now, listen to the next phrase, the next verse, what he calls him. For this son of mine, right? I mean, you know, this son has done so much, and he's left the father and he's left the family, but this father clothes him with the best robe, puts the ring on his finger, puts the sandals on his feet. Slaves don't wear sandals per se, but this son is being exalted. Why? Why is he being exalted? Because he has humbled himself, right? He has come back. He has accepted his position as the lowest. He's not worthy, and he knows it. But the Father will take him back and exalt him and take this humble son and raise him back up again. This son of mine was dead, the Father says, and has come to life again. He was lost, but now he is found. And they began to celebrate, right? Isn't that a beautiful story of forgiveness? I mean, isn't this great? Isn't this good news? Isn't this gospel that no matter what we have done, no matter where we have lived, no matter who we have served in the past, that if we can come to grips and repent of that life and realize that it's leading us to nothing but pig slop and mud, that we too can run to the Father and come back to the Father in our brokenness, in our acknowledgement of being unworthy of his forgiveness, and that we have a Father who is so compassionate that he is willing to run to us and forgive us and restore us to a position of glory. It's a beautiful story. But remember, this parable is not about one son, is it? It's about two sons. And about two sons. Look at verse 25. It says, now his older son, you know, this was the younger, who got a portion, right? If there are only two sons, you know, this boy would have most likely gotten 2/3 of the estate, the older. But there is another son. The older son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and he heard dancing, something that would have excited many people, right, to hear what's going on, what's so exciting, what's going on at home. But this kind of sound didn't entice him to joy, but caused him to be somewhat fearful, questionable. And he says, he summoned one of his servants, because he's not going to go look himself, but he summons one of his servants and began inquiring of these things and what they could be. In verse 27, he says, and he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound. So the father's willingness to forgive, and then again, it's still hard to believe. I mean, it's really hard to come to grips with, even for us. I mean, how could this father forgive someone who has wished him dead? How could this father forgive somebody who has sold a portion of the family estate and used it and squandered it for loose living? How could that father really forgive such a sinful lifestyle? But he does. Look at verse 28. It says, but he became very angry and was not willing to go in. And his father, right? His father comes out. He went out to the first son. Now he's coming out to the second son, right? Who's been there the whole time, obviously. So he comes out and he began pleading with him. You know, this is such a different scenario, right? The scene has changed. Things are different. Instead of the son being humble and recognizing that he is unworthy and desiring forgiveness and desiring to be part of the family, and the father running to him, now we have a father going out to the other son who has been there the whole time. He's been a faithful servant for this while, But now he has to plead with this son, to plead with him. But he answered and he said to his father, look, for so many years I have been serving you and I have never neglected a command of yours. And yet you have never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, notice how he acknowledges him, not my brother, right? But this son of yours came, who has devoured your wealth in prostitutes, you kill the fattened calf for him, right? And in a sense, we kind of acknowledge this, right? We kind of see this like, yeah, I know, that's crazy, isn't it? It doesn't make any sense. It's not logical. It doesn't make any sense at all. But that's what happened. But the attitude of the one who is there is one of anger and resentment, frustration. How dare you forgive my brother? Isn't that a weird attitude when we really put it in perspective? How dare you, Father, forgive him? How dare you be so forgiving? How dare you be so compassionate? How dare you? You should be ashamed of yourself for forgiving this brother, this son of yours. I mean, don't you know what he's done? And don't you know who I am, right? I mean, don't you know that I've always been here, that I've always kept your commandments, that I've done all the work, that I've had to labor twice as hard because my brother has been out there doing who knows what, who knows where. Here I am. I have never left your side. I have been faithful to you, and you have done nothing for me. Is that true? It's not true, right? And the father acknowledges that. He says, no, son, everything I have is yours, right? I understand and I see your faithfulness and I recognize the keeping of the commandments that I have given you and I know that. But you have to understand that this son of yours was, brother of yours was dead. He was lost. He was gone. And now he's back. And that is a time for celebration. And this brother just didn't get it. It didn't register. It didn't click. He didn't understand what was going on. What is all the celebration about? And because of his anger, because of his resentment, because of the forgiveness of the father, he will not go and sit at the table and celebrate because his father's son is there, and he does not want to forgive him. He does not believe he deserves forgiveness. What's the difference here? What's the contrast in these two brothers? How are we supposed to view these two brothers and understand where they're coming from? That's where the parable is leading us, right? It's leading us to the two brothers and their attitude towards the father's forgiveness. Look at verse 31. It says, son, you have always been with me, and all that is mine is yours, but we had to celebrate, right? We had to celebrate. We had to rejoice for this brother of yours. He's reminding him again. This is your brother. He was dead, but has been given life. He was lost, but has now been found. This parable about how forgiving the Heavenly Father is. This parable about how God and all of heaven rejoice, truly rejoice, over the sinner who is unworthy, but yet comes back and is restored, who is forgiven. That this whole parable is designed to make us think about our own life and to make us ask the very hard question, which brother am I? Which brother am I? Am I the brother who is willing to acknowledge my sin and come humbly before the Father, even willing to take the lowest place in the family just to be part of the family and have the provisions that the family has? Or am I this brother who feels that I have done so much and I am deserving and I am worthy that I will not come and sit at the Father's table and celebrate his forgiveness because I am worthy? Which brother am I? Where do I sit in God's forgiveness? Where do I sit in God's family? How do I acknowledge this? Because we see that one has humbled themselves and one is prideful. One believes he is unworthy, and one believes he is worthy. One will sit at the Father's table and celebrate his forgiveness, and the other will stand outside of the house and refuse to come in. He will refuse the forgiveness of the Father. He will refuse the forgiveness of this brother that was lost but now has been found. And the parable ends with a cliffhanger, right? I mean, we don't have a conclusion. We don't know what happened to the older brother. We don't have younger brother. We don't know if there was a family feud. We have no idea. But it's a cliffhanger. And I think it's designed that way. It's designed to stop right there. And then we continue the story. That we evaluate ourselves in light of this story. And we ask the hard question, which brother am I? Will I humble myself before the Father as a sinner and rejoice in his forgiveness, dine at his table, and then rejoice at other sinners who come and dine at the Lord's table and celebrate with God? Or will I be so prideful that I will refuse the Father's forgiveness because of those sinners who are sitting with him, because of those who I know have sinned, because of those who I know are unworthy? Will I be so self-righteous that I will decline the invitation and not come into the Father's house and celebrate his forgiveness? It's a hard question. It's a hard question. We need to wrestle with that. I hope this week that you think about this parable. Go back and read all of chapter 15 and wrestle with that question. Which brother am I? And then think about this, the Father's words. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found. And they began to celebrate. Let's rejoice in God's forgiveness. If there's anybody here this morning who desires to come back, maybe you have gone away from the family and you desire to come back, that opportunity is available for you. Let us pray with you and encourage you. If you have not become part of the family, if you have not been baptized into Jesus, that opportunity is available for you this morning. Come forward as we stand and as we sing.